This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Despite vaccines in development, the head of the World Health Organization is cautioning that the treatments have yet to prove effective. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has more.
The World Health Organization warned on Monday that despite strong hopes for a vaccine,
there is no bullet at the moment, and there might never be.
The director general of the WHO said there were concerns that vaccines might not prove effective or that they might convey protections for just a few months. He said, for now, stopping outbreaks hinged on the difficult task of testing, tracing, and social distancing. According to a Reuters tally, more than 18 million people around the world are reported to have been infected with the disease, and 688,000 have died.
That is Reuters' Zachary Goldman reporting. In the United States, which has about one-fourth of the world's cases, negotiations continue between the White House and congressional Democrats on a new aid package that would include federal money to help the millions of people who are unemployed. Australia's second most populous state, Victoria, military personnel will be deployed to enforce COVID-19 isolation orders. Australia, once heralded as a global leader in containing COVID-19, is desperately trying to slow the spread of the virus in Victoria to prevent a national second wave of infections. U.S. President Donald Trump says he will ban popular video app TikTok by September 15th unless the U.S. company Microsoft acquires it before then. In a statement, Microsoft confirms its CEO has met with Mr. Trump and is committed to acquiring the company by the stated deadline. For more information on the coronavirus, please go to voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. President Trump says efforts to get his tax returns released to a federal court in New York are part of the, quote, witch hunt against him. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. has been seeking 8 years of President Trump's personal and corporate tax records in connection with alleged hush money payments and what was termed a complex financial investigation. This week, he told a judge his justification was public allegations of possible criminal activity at the president's Trump organization. President Trump was asked about the court filing.
I said, what's this all about? I know nothing about it, but it's just a continuation of the witch hunt. Didn't work out for Congress, didn't work out for Mueller. Didn't work out for anybody.
Last month, the Supreme Court rejected claims by Trump's lawyers the president could not be criminally investigated while in office. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Hurricane Isaias is battering the North Carolina coast at this hour, bringing life-threatening storm surges as the entire eastern seaboard battened down, fearing flash floods and destructive winds. The storm is forecast to track up the East Coast, with heavy rainfall expected to cause flash flooding through the mid-Atlantic states and bringing storm-force winds to Washington, Philadelphia, and New York on Tuesday. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is proposing changes to the grounded 737 MAX jet. AP's Mike Gracia has more.
The Federal Aviation Administration has outlined several changes it wants to the Boeing 737 MAX jets after investigating two deadly crashes that killed 346 people. The FAA says it will require more redundancy for the flight control software called MCAS that pushed down the noses of the MAX jets that crashed in Indonesia in late 2018 and in Ethiopia in 2019. Plans to make MCAS less powerful so that pilots can respond if it mistakenly pushes the plane's nose down. MAX jets have been grounded worldwide since March 2019. I'm Mike Gracia.
South Korean authorities say days of heavy rain caused floods in the country that have forced more than 1,000 people from their homes, killing at least 13, with another 13 missing. Irish politician and Nobel Peace Prize winner John Hume has died at 83. Hume is best known for fashioning an agreement to end violence in his native Northern Ireland. Hume shared the 1998 Nobel Peace Prize with David Trimble, the first minister of Ireland at the time, for their role securing the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement. The agreement ended 3 decades of violence that left at least 3,500 people dead. For the very latest news, whenever you need it, go to voanews.com or download the VOA mobile app. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Tuesday, August 4th. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in this week for James Butte. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. Anti-government protests resume in Mali. We are out today to peacefully request administrative buildings to close. If you take a look at the education, health, the condition of our military, the country has fallen on its knees. That was a protester in Bamako, Mali. Also ahead, the top U.S. diplomat for the Sahel discusses the region's multiple crises. A former Darfuri refugee is now a state governor in Sudan. Cameroonian authorities shut down a church that preached anti-public health messages. Egypt allows churches to reopen as COVID-19 cases appear to decline. Plus, it's World Breastfeeding Week.
Breast milk is a baby's first immunization, so it's very important to also ensure that mothers continue to breastfeed their babies.
That was Toyin Adewale Gabriel of the International Health Organization FHI Solutions in Nigeria. All those stories are next on Daybreak Africa. Our top story today is in Mali, where the M5-RFP opposition restarted its campaign of civil disobedience Monday following the three-day Muslim Eid al-Adha festival. In recent months, thousands of demonstrators took to the streets to protest against rampant insecurity, as well as what they say is corruption and nepotism in the government of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. Now the opposition is calling for the president to step down. But turnout for Monday's protests was unexpectedly low. Still, those who did show up were defiant. This protester says, "We are out today. We are not going to say which day or when to stop. There will be no limit and time when we will stop this." According to a protest organizer, three people were injured during Monday's demonstrations, but there were no clashes with security forces. There were fears that clashes would take place after Mali's president said over the weekends that the government would not accept any blockages of free movement. Here's another protester from Monday's demonstrations in Bamako. He says, "If you see, all of us have left our daily jobs to come do this. It simply means we are tired. Enough is enough, so people should recognize that people that are doing these protests have regular jobs. This is not a group of people with no jobs trying to do something bad using this opportunity. We are tired and feel the bad governance. We want people to be aware of that." One protest organizer said Monday's low turnout was because the opposition is now employing, quote, guerrilla tactics, end quote, meaning that they intend to send smaller groups of 50 or 100 people to more quietly shut down government offices. One photo showed a makeshift barricade of brick and metal piled in front of the Ministry of Finance and Economics. Here's another protester. He says, "We are out today to peacefully request administrative buildings to close. If you take a look at the education, health, the condition of our military, the country has fallen on its knees. We are giving our life, our money to stand up to something. We are not going to burn or destroy our cities. We are very unhappy with this leadership." Despite the new tactics, other protest organizers said the smaller turnout was because senior leaders of the M5-RFP are meant to hold a strategic meeting today, Tuesday. That development has sparked speculation that the opposition is not fully unified on a way forward. The Mali-based news site Sahelian.com reported Monday that there are disagreements among the movement's leadership. Meanwhile, in central Mali on Sunday, an ambush on a military convoy and an artillery attack on a camp left five Malian army soldiers dead and five others wounded, the AFP news agency reported. Army and local sources told the news agency that both attacks were blamed on jihadists. Thanks to VOA's Bambara language service, including my colleague Madibo Dembele for contributing reporting from Bamako, as well as journalist Nicolas Pinot, who reported for VOA from Paris, France. Now, Mali's political crisis isn't the only crisis in Africa's troubled Sahel region. On Monday, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres strongly condemned, quote, heinous attacks, end quote, against civilians in Chad and Cameroon, which have taken place in the past week. A UN spokesman said in a statement released Monday. The statement said the attacks led to the killing and abduction of many civilians, including women, children, and displaced people who had fled previous violence. The UN's statement comes after suspected militants from the Boko Haram group killed at least 16 people and wounded seven others on Sunday in a grenade attack on a camp for displaced people in northern Cameroon, Reuters reported. For more on the multiple crises in the Sahel, my VOA colleague Anita Powell in Johannesburg, South Africa, spoke to J. Peter Pham, who is the U.S. Special Envoy to the troubled region. Powell filed this report.
Amid the world focus on the coronavirus pandemic, another force is bringing death and destruction to the vast arid region of Africa known as the Sahel. J. Peter Pham is a U.S. top envoy to the region and says recent developments there are of great concern.
In the last quarter, by our count, that's the quarter ended June 30th, there were 270 attacks by extremists in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. That number represents an almost 40% increase from a year earlier. So that's significant. That's worrisome as a trend.
UN peacekeepers and U.S. forces have worked for several years on a multi-billion dollar peacekeeping mission in the region, though the Trump administration has publicly questioned the value of the costly mission and pushed to cut budgets and troop numbers in Africa. Pham says this is fundamentally a governance problem, not a military one.
Let's face it, if we really examine the crisis in the Sahel at the end of the day, it's a crisis in state legitimacy, in governance, in providing basic goods and services and inclusion to various populations. As a result of this, I'm particularly concerned about recent human rights abuses, which have been reported, especially the ones reported out of Burkina Faso by Human Rights Watch. These abuses have to stop because not only are they morally and ethically wrong, but they're also counterproductive in the fight against extremism by delegitimizing governments, alienating people from them.
It is, military officials acknowledge, a tough battle for them to shoulder. U.S. Air Force Major General Marcus Hicks, the head of U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, told VOA in 2018, "We are not winning in the fight to stamp out violent extremism led by several al-Qaeda-linked groups in the region." Pham noted weak institutions like Mali's challenged government have also sparked public protests that may lead to further instability. So VOA asked Pham, "Are we winning in the Sahel?"
It depends on what time horizon you use and what definition you use for winning. If it's scoring specific successes, I think what our French partners managed to do with U.S. cooperation and support with the elimination of the emir of al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Malik Drukdel, a month or so ago, that certainly was a success. On the other hand, the expansion of insecurity in places like Burkina Faso, in the Middle Belt of Mali, certainly cannot be accounted a success. So I think there are specific successes in this long fight. At the same time, ongoing challenges and difficulties. So I think it's a matter of accounting and how one looks at that.
There's no straight answer, he said, because this is not a straightforward military problem with conventional forces on the battlefield. This is, he said, a situation that requires attention, patience, and diplomacy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For nearly two decades, Sudan's Darfur region has been in almost constant conflict, and Darfur has been ruled mostly by military men. But last month, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok appointed a group of civilian governors to lead each of Darfur's five states as part of Sudan's transitional government, which includes both civilian and military figures. One of the new civilian governors is Adib Yusuf. Yusuf is from Darfur, but during the reign of Sudan's former dictator Omar al-Bashir, he had to flee his home and gained political asylum in the United States. While in the U.S., he earned a Ph.D. at George Mason University's School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution near Washington, D.C. After Bashir fell from power last year, Yusuf returned to Sudan amid protests calling for a civilian government. He has remained in Sudan ever since, doing research and peacebuilding activities until last week when he was appointed governor of Central Darfur State. On Monday, I spoke to Yusuf about what it's like to go from being on the run to running a state government in Darfur.
I feel happy that I'm a governor, and my happiness is for many reasons. Among them, I'm going to help the people in Darfur.
Now, you are a citizen of the United States. You came to the United States as a refugee many years ago after fleeing violence and threats in Darfur. How does it feel to now be able to return to your home in Darfur as a top government official?
Yes, it was true that I was chased by the previous government. After they put me in jail in Sudan, and they attempt to assassinate me, and that is why I was forced to leave to the United States to seek for your protection. When I came back home, I was thinking about this from different point of view. One, we want like a civilian government that can respect human rights and human value, human dignity. And that is what I'm gonna apply the value of humanity. I will never accept this random arrest built on revenge, and I will stand for human value and human rights principle.
Your appointment comes at a very tense time in Darfur. In recent weeks, dozens of people have been killed in attacks throughout much of the region. There was an attack in Mesteri village in West Darfur state that left about 60 people dead. Another attack recently in South Darfur state that left about 20 people dead. And other attacks have taken place in North Darfur state. Can you talk about what you're going to do as governor in this very difficult time for Darfur?
I think it was the right time, and that is why I was appointed as the governor, to help with the conflict resolution skills that I learned in the United States. So it is a critical time, full of tragedy. But at the same time, I have the knowledge, the capacity, the ability, and the willingness to help the people. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to work with others in order to bring peace and security to Darfur.
Now, looking at the government's response to these killings in Darfur, the prime minister said that they would send troops to control the situation. Some of those troops have arrived. Do you have any update?
Troops, some of them, they arrive. Other of them, they are on their way. And they are going to different states in Darfur. Few of them, they are going to stop in central Darfur. Many of them, they are going to west Darfur. And the rest, they are going to south Darfur. Right now, as I'm speaking, the violence in central Darfur have decreased. And I've been working in central Darfur for more than a year, trying to establish human rights groups, trying to establish peace committees. And I think this is what helped in decreasing the violence in central Darfur. As I'm talking, there is a bloody violence in western Darfur and in south Darfur, but there's no conflict or clashes in central Darfur.
Last of all, Sudan's transitional government, which came to power last year, is a mix of both civilian leaders like yourself and military leaders. On the military side, that includes General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is also known as Hemeti. He's the leader of the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Now, the RSF is accused of actually carrying out many attacks in the past in Darfur against civilians. Now that you are part of the transitional government, how do you plan on working with these military leaders, including the RSF, who have been accused of violating human rights?
In fact, the headquarters of the Rapid Support Forces are here in Khartoum. Commander of the Rapid Support Forces is the deputy of the Sovereignty Council. So he has a presence here in Khartoum, and this has become a reality. What I'm going to do, I'm going to help the rapid support forces with a package of peace building and peacemaking activities. I'm going to help them with human rights trainings to respect human rights, human being. And that's what I'm going to work to reform the rapid support forces.
That was Adib Yusuf, governor of Sudan's central Darfur state. Authorities in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, have sealed a popular Christian church for falsely preaching that COVID-19 does not exist. The church has been telling its 300 members to ignore medical advice on social distancing, wearing masks, and even washing their hands. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Music is played on loudspeakers by a group of seven members of the Tabernacles of Freedom's Ministries in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The four women and three men move from house to house and street to street, calling themselves end-time evangelists. 32-year-old Prudence Maya, the group leader, is referred to by church members as Sister. She says last month, God revealed to them through their pastor, Ngwa Atangana, that nations are wasting the time and resources being spent on fighting COVID-19.
We are asking everybody to go on their knees and pray and know that there is nothing like a coronavirus. It is God's punishment for wrongdoing. For the several wars people are fighting in the world, a man marries a man and a woman marries a woman. So God is very angry.
Among the 45 homes the group said it visited on Monday is that of 49-year-old farmer Leonie Fotso. Fotso says she believes in the teachings of the small church and will follow its orders not to wear masks.
Ça n'existe pas. Pour nous, ça n'existe pas. Je suis un bayam, je pas en blouse, je pas partout.
She says Tabernacles of Freedom's Ministries has just confirmed her thoughts that COVID-19 is a hoax. She says no member of a group of 300 farmers where she belongs has ever attested that she saw a COVID-19 patient and none of them has been sick of the so-called coronavirus. COVID-19 is very real, killing more than 1 million people worldwide since December. There have been more than 17,000 cases in Cameroon alone and about 400 deaths in the Central African state. But that doesn't stop the Tabernacles Church, which has about 300 followers and reaches more people with broadcasts on Yaoundé radio stations. Last week, Governor Nasiri Paul Biya of Cameroon's Central Region said three students refused to take their secondary school certificate exams because they were asked to wear masks. When the students' parents were asked to come to school and convince their children to wear the masks, the parents chose to take their children home. The parents said they were members of the church. The governor says he has ordered the church to follow instructions on COVID-19 prevention or be arrested.
We have already closed down this church for anti-government policy. You can imagine, some of our youths have refused vaccination. Some of them are now refusing barrier measures. Some of them refuse even just to go to the hospitals. That if you die, they can pray and you come back to life.
Even with the closure of the church, members have continued organizing their daily prayers and meetings in front of the sealed building. The church says it also sends out 15 groups of seven on a daily basis to preach its erroneous message about COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Egypt is reopening churches for the first time in nearly 4 months after a major decline in the number of reported coronavirus cases in recent days. The number of reported new cases is also down in Sudan, while Libya, Tunisia, and Algeria have been witnessing an increase in cases. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Worshippers gathered for the first church service in nearly 4 months in Egypt's historic port city of Alexandria.
Authorities reopened churches across the country on Monday. Those attending appeared to abide by strict safety rules regarding social distancing and the use of face masks. Mosques are open on weekdays but remain closed for Friday prayers and major holidays. Egypt's health ministry indicated Sunday that there were just 167 new cases during the previous 24 hours and only 31 deaths. Figures for new cases have fallen dramatically in recent days, prompting the government to relax a number of restrictions. Neighboring Sudan has also witnessed a relative drop in the number of cases in recent days, with under 100 new cases per day for most of the past week. Nearby Libya, however, is witnessing a rise in the number of new infections, according to Arab media. Libyan news channel 218 TV reported that the Islamist militia-dominated port city of Misrata has been placed under curfew by authorities after six people died of COVID-19 over the weekend. Arab media reports say that mercenaries from outside Libya have been entering the country through Misrata. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the National Defense University in Washington, tells VOA that he thinks the recent increase in the number of cases in Libya is likely due in part to the movement of mercenaries into the country. He adds that in periods of conflict, social distancing takes a back seat, particularly if you are a mercenary who's not part of the community. Meanwhile, Algeria, with a population of about 44 million people, has seen a rise in the number of cases to more than 600 a day in recent days, double the number of infections from just a month ago. The European Union suspended travel from Algeria to the EU last week due to the increase. Said Sadik, well-known Egyptian political sociologist who is now in Tunisia, tells VOA that he thinks there has been a rise in the number of coronavirus infections in Tunisia and other parts of North Africa because many people began relaxing their behavior after the number of cases dropped. He adds many family members visit from France and other parts of Europe, bringing the virus back with them. Saudi TV reported that there were no reported cases of COVID-19 among those who participated in this year's annual Hajj or Islamic pilgrimage. Saudi Information Minister Majid al-Qasri noted that the extensive spread of the coronavirus and its clear danger to humanity forced Saudi Arabia to seriously limit the number of people attending this year's pilgrimage. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This week is World Breastfeeding Week. For more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Toyin Adewale Gabriel of the FHI Solutions Health Organization in Nigeria.
Well, as you know, the COVID-19 pandemic situation is unprecedented. At first, there was initially some confusion for mothers in relation to breastfeeding and COVID. Also, there was a significant drop in attendance at clinics and also for immunization because mothers felt that coming to the facility put them at risk of infection. But then a lot of work has been done with new guidance says that once you follow the protocols, wearing of the face mask and also making sure that the hands are washed, it's safe to continue to breastfeed. So gradually, as the restrictions have been eased in Nigeria, there's also been a corresponding increase at the facilities.
So there is no transmission of COVID through breast milk itself?
No, there's no evidence that there's COVID transmission through the breast milk. But breast milk is a baby's first immunization. So it's very important to also ensure that mothers continue to breastfeed their babies.
Tell us again why breast milk is so important.
Breast milk is medicine. It has all the nutrients that the baby needs to keep growing for the first 1,000 days of life. And it's very, very important that mothers and families maximize the benefits of breast milk, especially in this COVID-19 pandemic, to provide the most immunity against disease they can provide for their babies.
Of course, the economic impact of COVID has meant widespread economic dislocation, along with fear of famine.
Well, you know, the National Bureau of Statistics have done some studies on the economic impact of the pandemic on livelihoods. And you can see the inflation since May has been growing month by month. Things are extremely expensive, but breast milk comes cost-free. It's available. And the science is out there that even when the mother does not have enough nutrition for herself, she's still able to provide enough breast milk for her baby.
That was Toyin Adewale Gabriel speaking to my VOA colleague, Adam Phillips. That's it for this Tuesday, August 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm Jason Patingin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.